Hey, the Shilling Show rolls on. And tying into our first segment, we're talking about National Socialists and their leanings, their anti-Semitic leanings, and their political leanings. I want to get into today the use of force to bring about utopia. And that would be the vision of the socialists. David Murata is our guest. He is the president of Murata Wealth Management, online at murataonmoney.com. I was thinking about this and this conversation, and David, welcome to the show, and I'm so glad you're here today to have this conversation. I think this is the first in the series. But I was thinking about how just a few short years ago, and I'm going back to 2010, we had a local teacher who was caught on film, an Albemarle County school teacher, saying something about liking socialism, and it was a scandal. And today, we have people openly embracing it. In the last 8 or 9 years, what has happened that changed everything in America?
Yeah, I knew there was a problem when the most common question I was asked about politics was, what's wrong with socialism? I knew that was a bad trend for the past several years.
Who's been asking you that?
Just people who read the column or something. Yeah. And it used to be you could say, and that is a socialist idea, and that would end the conversation because socialism was accepted as not a good philosophy mm-hmm. to have. And now we've got outright socialists running for president. You know, I'm a libertarian, so it's a very difficult, you know, in terms of parties. But in the Democratic Party, I'm more of a bourbon Democrat or even a blue dog Democrat. Mm-hmm. I agree with them much more. And blue dog Democrats are pretty much the ones who picked up seats in the 2018 election because mm-hmm. they have reasonable fiscal views. But none of them are running for president. The ones who are running for president are pretty much all on the very left edge of socialism. I say left edge, the totalitarian edge, the mm-hmm. centralized planning edge. You know, when you're a libertarian, you know, you don't look at politics quite the same way. The very left edge of the Democrat Party, we think is libertarians. It's somewhere on the far upper end of totalitarian centralized planning,
right?
Which is really where socialism runs. I was a philosophy undergraduate major at Stanford, so I'm always interested in the history of ideas and where they come from, and just, you know, my whole background and training is not just to look at an idea, but to look at the roots of the idea and the underlying premise of the idea. And I was looking at science fiction stories that have influenced and talked about politics, and I ran across a science fiction story which is basically the root of socialist thought in the United States. And I was very surprised by that because I thought, I love science fiction. Why have mm-hmm. I never heard of a science fiction story that is the root of all socialism in the United States? And the reason is because it was published in 1888 by Edward Bellamy. And just to give you an idea that you've never heard of this book, and yet this book has been cited by everyone from Mark Twain to President Roosevelt. Roosevelt said it was very influential in his thinking and mm-hmm. in his understanding. It was, in its day, the most popular book in America. It was beating out both the Bible and Ben-Hur. That's sort of the era that it's from. And it formed a whole political awakening in terms of socialism. It was cited by all the socialists from the early 1920s as being influential in their upbringing. It sparked over 162 Bellamy clubs to discuss the ideals and you know, the sort of salons to talk about how could we get this implemented and what would this look like in society. And the book was called Looking Backwards, mm-hmm. 2000 to 1887. So the premise of the book is that the main character falls asleep into some kind of coma or sleep in 1887, and he wakes up in the year 2000, and the United States is a socialist utopia.
Yeah.
And so he's like, what happened? Mm-hmm. And the rest of the story is basically his guests of the day explaining to him how the United States became a socialist utopia and how it came about and what it looked like today. And on like that. And really all of the premise of socialism can be found in the book. So it has everything in it, which is just very straightforward. Here's the premise of why socialism works and here's why it doesn't. Or here's why capitalism has failed mm-hmm. and why it's been replaced by this utopia. And, you know, I talk about socialist utopia. I'm really talking about the same thing that is talked about in A Conflict of Two Visions by Thomas Sowell, or by The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker. It goes by various names, but there's really two different views in the world. And one I call the utopian view, sometimes the socialist utopian view, or mm-hmm. the centralized planner utopian view. And the other one is the tragic view, or sometimes it's called the constrained view, the idea that man is not perfectible and you can't bring about this utopia and you have to work with what you have and you have to have a different view of human nature. And those two views are really the two different political views in the world. And it's why a number of things line up on one side or the other. So even if you're not an outright socialist, if you're a centralized planner or a modern day progressive, this view is really the view I'm talking about. The idea that centralized planning and rules and regulations from government and government actions can bring about a better society. And there's 100 different premise in this book that are followed throughout all of thought in terms of since then for the last 100 years. And one of the things that I found interesting was where Bellamy talks about how to handle those who refuse to comply with their socialist view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little quote. He's talking about how they've got this whole economic engineering core, and how without competition, all of economics works better without competition, because you don't have all that waste of mm-hmm. people trying to compete with one another. And here's what he talks about, because the question is asked, you know, what if people don't want to go to their job? And Bellamy has this wonderful section, and this is the quote. As for the actual neglect of work, positively bad work, or other overt remissiveness on the part of men incapable of generous motives, the discipline of the industrial army is far too strict to allow anything whatsoever of the sort. A man able to do his duty and persistently refusing is sentenced to solitary imprisonment on bread and water till he consents.
That's pretty harsh. And it's interesting to me, the contrast of today's America is that we reward those who don't work with welfare and other means of support and Obama phones and all that. But those are the very same people who are calling for increased socialism. There seems to be a big disconnect there, because if that's the end, all the people who are the beneficiaries of today's largesse, they'll be winding up in the gulag somewhere.
It's exactly right. Or maybe it's the productive people who refuse to work for those people
mm-hmm.
Who'll end up in the gulag. But but yeah, I mean, his idea of bread and water, he thought was actually very humane, because he's not killing them. So his idea is, look, you just restrict them down to bread and water until they do what you want them to do. Mm-hmm. You put them, you know, in solitary confinement. To him, that was very humane, because they're not starving. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't lack anything. They have bread and water, but they don't have any of the benefits of society. And the benefits of society are only for those who comply. That's basically the premise of socialism. What do you do with people who dissent? You have to do something with them. And so, you know, first, of course, you try to persuade them. But what do you do when persuasion fails? Next, you try to compel them. What do you do when compelling fails? And ultimately, you have to come down to the use of force. You have to take away their freedoms and take away everything that they value until they will comply. And that's the problem with utopia. When people don't agree with your utopian values, then you have to punish them in some way until they're willing to fall in line.
Indeed. We're going to elaborate on that in the next segment. David Murad is our guest, MuradOnMoney.com, talking to you about the use of force to bring about the socialist utopia, which really and truly is a nightmare. Stay with The Shilling Show. We'll be back. And of course, you're welcome here, 434-977-1070. Comments or questions, robs@wina.com. Hey, we're continuing here with David Murata, Murata Wealth Management, and the topic today is the use of force to bring about the socialist utopia in America. We see it happening here, and I want to go to a quote that you have for us by someone named Niebuhr that I was not familiar with previous to our conversation today, and then I would like to extrapolate that a little bit. So go right ahead, please.
Yeah, it was interesting. I ran across Niebuhr's book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, in a quote from Friedrich Hayek in The Road to Serfdom. And he was basically, Niebuhr in 1931, so it's a very old book, was talking about, quote, an increasing tendency among modern men to imagine themselves ethical because they have delegated their vices to larger and larger groups.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hayek's use of the quotes, he was talking about how if you yourself would never hold a gun to someone's head and demand 70% of their income, you could delegate that to the state collecting that 70% income tax, and now you feel good because you didn't have to use force to do that. You're delegating to the state the force to do that. And this idea that state actions with the use of force and the threat of force and all of that are okay, and that liberals can think that's okay because they've delegated it to the state, is actually the very reason why Penn Jillette, on his journey to libertarian values, became a libertarian, because he said he didn't want the state to use violence in his name for anything that he would not be willing to use violence for. Therefore, he believes, you know, for example, that you shouldn't hold a gun to someone's head and demand that they fund a library. And so he always asks the question, is there any way we can solve this problem with more freedom instead of less? Mm. And I think it's a fault among liberals that all of the things that they want to do, they have to use force to implement. They can't seem to find a cooperative way in society of being able to do what they want to do. They jump immediately to, well, why don't we just have a law and confiscate this money from the people who've earned it and use this money for whatever we want, because we can't seem to find a way to find this money to do the good things we want to do. And since the things are goods and the ends justifies the means, we'll just hold a gun to people's head and force them to do what we want them to do. And then we'll feel good about ourselves because we're doing wonderful things with other people's money and with other people's time and with other people's decisions. Isn't it great that we're able to do this?
Oh, I love that you brought this up, because there's a local group of quasi-spiritualists called Impact, which are a bunch of people who get together in various quote-unquote denominations and demand that the government do all this stuff to increase taxes. Will you vow to increase taxes and spend this kind of money on this and that? Instead of doing it themselves, I call them lazy-ass spiritualists, because they won't get off their butts and do what the Bible actually tells them to do. Instead, they're calling on government to do it. So we have it right in our very backyard. It's an offshoot of ACORN and the Obama Organizing for America groups. And this is exactly what's happening right here in Charlottesville from this group Impact.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't think the left has ever realized that the people who are willing to use that kind of violence are some of the worst people in society. Friedrich Hayek in The Road to Serfdom, his chapter 10 is called "Why the Worst Always Get on Top," and he talks about how any collective use of force is by itself wrong. And therefore, you're going to have the worst people who want to do that. And then he has three reasons why if you ever do get a homogeneous enough view to implement that kind of force, three reasons why it's going to be from among the worst impulses. Mm-hmm. And his first reason is it's the lowest common denominator, which usually unites the largest number of people. So it's going to be the masses picking on a minority group. And then it's going to be support will be gained from the docile and gullible who have no strong convictions of their own. So it's going to be the majority gullible picking on people with strong convictions. And then it's easier to unite people based on the common hatred of an enemy, usually an enemy of those that are better off than on any positive task. So let's go get the 1% from among the 99%, and we'll make them our slaves and make them take away their money,
mm-hmm.
Which is basically what happened in Nazi Germany. The Jews were categorized as being those rich bankers taking mm-hmm. away the values of the German people. And if we just go take away their money and their wealth and their businesses, then everything will be right with the world. So it always has this lowest common denominator impulses. And when you're willing to go to the use of force, it will always have the worst people being in charge of doing that.
I want to play for you a sound clip I haven't played in a long time, but this goes back to the Occupy movement and when the occupiers were very active here, that whole 99% and the 1% thing. Just to show, to put an exclamation point after what you just said, let's listen to this one.
It's highly visible. It's on the trolley line. There's more foot traffic and vehicle traffic than there is here. More rich people that we would be sticking it to.
So the whole idea was, let's stick it to rich people. Let's go after rich people. And that was going back to about 2010. Very recently, we have had Charlottesville city councilors attempting to increase taxes on property owners in order to take the money from them and give it to other people. Not because the government needed it, but just because we should be very active in redistributing money. Again, going after people who are successful simply because of the fact that they're successful.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how quickly we are to try to stick it to rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, if you're just have two families and one family buys iPhones and one family doesn't buy iPhones and they save and invest, the difference between that is going to be $1 million over their working career.
Mm.
So who do you want to reward, the one that lives rich with iPhones or the one that has wealth and saves and invests? Exact same income, but different results. And when you're trying to make an equality of results, it requires an enormous state apparatus and the use of violence and the threat of violence to enforce whatever definition of equality that you're trying to sustain. Meanwhile, that massive bureaucracy of wealth redistribution is subject to the weakness of corruption, abuse, and self-serving bias. So the angels that you think that are implementing this have no angelic motives, and the people that you're trying to stick it to may very well be simply the most responsible people in your society.
You know, it kind of reminds me, I hope I've got the right fable here. Is it the ant and the grasshopper that would correspond to the thing you just said about iPhones or people saving their money?
It is. The grasshopper fiddles and the ant saves. And then when the hard time comes, the ant has food.
We have a challenge here from Ken the Democrat, who said, how do the left laws use force and the rights do not? How do the left's laws use force and the rights do not? Because we're talking about the left use of force here. I'm sure he's only listening out of his left ear, and he probably missed the distinction, but let's address that head on.
Sure, and I would say on the right side, when they're trying to implement social values, they're using force. So I would concede to him that all laws use force. And this brings up a point. The media seems to want to say that the most productive Congress is the one that passes the most laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an incredible bias on the media's part when they talk about the most productive Congress ever. Maybe the most productive Congress would be the one that repealed the most laws. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would be better. And yet they say it with a straight face, and they talk about the productivity of Congress, and they talk about how Congress is wasting time and we've got this agenda that needs to get done. When in fact those laws are maybe very well bad laws, like Obamacare or the Affordable Care, the so-called Affordable Care Act, maybe that was one of the worst pieces of legislation in the past 25 years, and we're still paying for it. And maybe the Congress that passed that ought to be graded very poorly, not because they didn't pass a lot of laws, but because they passed bad laws. One way of looking at it is, for Ken, one way of looking at it is the use of force is recognized by a host of different names. Of pieces of legislation. So anytime you hear any of these words, you should think holding a gun to someone's head and making them do something. So mandate, regulate, ban, tax, legislate, universal, for all, centralized, subsidized, free. All of those words mean we're going to use force to be able to do something. So I agree with Ken. The legislation on the right, if they're not repealing laws, is quite often also putting things into place that is the use of force. And I would say, what are you willing to hold a gun to someone's head for? So you better believe that someone's being murdered to have a law that you want to hold a gun to someone's head. So if you don't think someone's being murdered or there's the use of force or fraud, maybe we shouldn't have that law. Maybe we shouldn't have a law that says, you know what, let's just take money from one set of people and give it to another set of people. Maybe we shouldn't have a law that says, I mean, because the laws that are trying to tax very productive people at 70%, if you do the equations of taxation, what that means is those people shouldn't start businesses. It's not in their best interest to start a business because the risk of starting a business will not produce enough return to justify the riskiness of starting a business. So the very people who have money and who might start businesses, you will put laws into effect to say they shouldn't, and you'll just have less businesses.
I want to say a couple things about this whole topic here and Ken the Democrat's point. And the issue is, I think, in many ways, one of quantity. While you concede, and I would agree, that you know law has force, the people that I know that are on the right, the ones, the Tea Party-oriented individuals, the constitutionalists and so forth, they favor small government. The people on the Ken the Democrat side favor big government. So you're talking about increasing the quantity of force or decreasing the quantity of force. And as for the productivity of Congress, I remember during the time when Tom Perriello was challenging Virgil Goode, and Tom Perriello ran a commercial making fun of Virgil Goode for only of having like four bills in the last session, and one of them was to name a post office after somebody, which, by the way, was a deceased a veteran of the United States military. And I thought, you know, this is how corrupt our society has been. You get some idiot like Tom Perriello and preaching to the choir of useful idiots who voted for him, saying, hey, when I get there, the more laws I pass, the better I am. And this guy, Virgil Goode, who I still hold in high regard to this day, only passed four bills in his last term of Congress. Isn't that horrible?
Yeah. And I would say, you know, along with Heinlein, another great science fiction story, the moon is a harsh mistress. Maybe we should have an entire branch of government that does nothing but repeal laws. Mm. And maybe they should be able to repeal laws with just a one-third minority. Because if one-third of the people don't think a law is good, maybe we shouldn't have it. And maybe new laws should have a two-thirds majority, because maybe if two-thirds of the people don't think it's a good law, we shouldn't have it. And so that would produce more freedom. And it would produce a lot less centralized planning. And centralized planning has some really disastrous results, because what centralized planners want to do is they want to fix things. And so if something is the price of something is too high, they want to make it lower. But in every equation of mathematics and supply and demand and economics, if you fix one thing, you make something else blow up. So if you try to make prices low, what you'll make is supply low, and then you'll have shortages. And all of those happen as a law of nature. You can't break those laws of nature. And so when they do, they hold one thing down and then something else blows up, they blame the free market for the other thing blowing up, when in fact it was the one thing that they held down which caused the problem. So although, you know, liberals are often, you know, looking at the libertarians or the right and saying, you know, you guys don't believe in science. Libertarians at least believe in the science of economics, and liberals don't. Mm-hmm. They think that they can have a command economy in which they set prices and they set everything that's going on. Those who have the constrained view believe that prices are best set by the market as a whole, and it's a distributed system. So the market as a whole will figure out there's a shortage in one area, the prices will go up, and people will supply that without any centralized planner even knowing that there's a problem. The problem will get solved through the free market of economics. Liberals will say, hey, there's a problem in this area, and there because there's a hurricane, and so we should make laws that keep prices low, and therefore you have shortages in that area, because who wants to go into a hurricane area and sell for no extra money? Mm-hmm. So the problem with centralized systems is they are infragile. They don't correct themselves after economic shocks. They're fragile. But distributed systems are what Taleb would call infragile, meaning that they automatically correct themselves, and shocks to the system will help make them more efficient. And that's the difference between a centralized planning system and a system which is more generic. Imagine in your body if you had to direct where blood cells are carrying oxygen to every cell in the body.
You can never handle the capacity of that.
You couldn't. You couldn't. You would need to be omniscient and know every cell in your body. And yet your body works because it is an infragile system that heals itself. Mm-hmm. And that's what libertarians and small government people want to produce. We want to put into place the kinds of things that will have infragile systems that will automatically solve themselves, and you don't have to have centralized planning.
We're running late on this segment, but we have one more brief segment left with David Morata. What a fascinating conversation. We're never going to get to all of it, but we continue the final segment of The Shilling Show with David Morata. All right, we are into the final few minutes here with David Morata, and this is one for the record books, and I hope you'll share the podcast with your friends to talk about the socialist utopia and the use of force. And I want to go back to something that you said real quickly, because I think this is critical, and there's a lot of people I know who I think are very well-intentioned who think price gouging laws are good in the aftermath of natural disasters. You mentioned a hurricane and goods, and it kind of reminded me of the body distributing resources when there is some sort of an attack or a wound. Let's talk about why price gouging laws are really a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine for a minute that there's a hurricane and the drinking supply has been polluted, and therefore they need to have bottled water brought in. Well, normally bottled water costs whatever it costs, but when you're trying to, in an emergency basis, truck it into a hurricane disaster area, it should cost more. It requires more resources to get there, and to stop everything and deliver water to a new area just should cost more money. And if it does cost more money, voluntary exchange benefits both parties. Someone there wants water and is probably willing to pay $5 a bottle for it, and some supplier is probably willing to deliver it for three instead mm-hmm. of one. And those two can find a happy medium. Anywhere between three and five, they're both happy. Voluntary exchange benefits both parties. Meanwhile, the government says you can't sell it for more than one, and the deliverers say, well, and why am I going to deliver it there and make all this effort and pay my drivers, time and a half for overtime to drive all night to get it there. And the people there saying, why are you limiting it to one? I'm willing to pay two, three,
four. We want
four.
It. We need
I want it.
It.
Yeah, yeah, I want it and I need it. And the problem with that is when decision-making is taken away from individuals and it's put in the hands of centralized planners, not only is the power transferred to the state, it's also concentrated and vastly increased. Because now the only way that we can get bottled water there is by an act of Congress to say, let's go deliver water there. And now it's got to be paid for out of the state coffers in order to do that, when the private sector could have done it probably more efficiently for less money. And so that's one of the problems. People say, the power is the same either way. No, when you have a monopoly on power, the power is vastly increased. And any government action and any government set of laws is a monopoly on power. And I think we as a society are rightly against monopolies in the private sector, mm-hmm. but we are too quick to go to monopolies on the government sector.
Well, I think what people don't understand is that those who are running government are just as subject to being vile, evil, greedy people as anyone else. And so, but when you put them in a place where they're untouchable, there is no market force to adjust that. And we can just look at some of the examples in America today and around the world.
Yeah, not only do they have their own incentives, but they also are unable to act without an act of law. So they don't respond very quickly. They have to do that. And final, I just thought this is an interesting quote from C.S. Lewis, and that is, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive.
Mm.
It may be better to live under robber barons than under an omnipotent moral busybody. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, his cupidity may at some point be satisfied, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience.
Ain't it the truth?
that's the thing that I think is the worst about the liberal view, is they think that they have somehow the moral high ground, and they don't realize how oppressive and how much it runs over other people. It is very difficult for liberals to realize how many free choices that they're ruining simply by having a set of laws.
Indeed. And I'm sorry that we're out of time, because we got a caller on the line. We're just not going to be able to get there. We're just about at the end of it. But a really fascinating dissertation, David Murata, and a wonderful and important discussion today. And to be continued, you can visit him online at muratahonmoney.com. And David Murata, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.